Well, hello all. We are racing toward the end of 2023, and on today's episode, we are going to cover one of the trends that we feel might pop in 2024, and that is open banking. So grab a cup of eggnog, sit back, relax, and tune in. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. I am joined, as ever, by the talented David Brassard. Hey, David, how are you doing?
Good morning, good afternoon. Doing good. How about you, Kelly?
Not bad. Not bad. That totally reminded me of the Truman Show. Good morning, good afternoon, and if I don't see you, good evening and good night.
I sometimes think we live in a world like the Truman Show, which is great because I don't have to worry about what's going to happen in the morning. It's all been scripted for me.
Oh, goodness. If somebody can pass me that script and I can know whether I need to pack extra clothes for my two little guys, I would deeply appreciate it. But I digress. So, yes, as it's so hard to believe, we are at the end of what's been an absolutely wildly busy year, particularly when it comes to access management and authorization. So I know that when we talked about what we wanted to cover off in this episode, there was something that was on your mind, which was fantastic. And I had to do a little bit more digging on this, and it was totally fascinating. So we're going to talk a lot about open banking. So before we dig in, to provide a level set for our listeners, David, can you share a little bit more about what open banking is and why listeners should care?
Oh, for sure. First of all, it's something that I'm personally very interested in, and not just specifically the banking part of open banking, but more so the open part of open banking. The idea that whatever we do in life generates data, and that we can get access to that data for what purposes, I think that's just fascinating. There are a lot of initiatives around the world around open data. So it's quite literally called open data. A lot of it has been in transportation systems where as a consumer, you can get access to ridership data for the city of, say, Chicago, and then you can have fun building visualizations and so on and so forth. Along that line, I'm a huge fan of a website called Information is Beautiful, which I really recommend people check out. If you just Google Information is Beautiful, you'll find it. The person running it is a wizard at visualizing in very creative and beautiful ways all the data that we humans generate. Now, open banking kind of was born from the whole idea that data should be accessible. It also stemmed from the fact that when you use a service like a bank, you, the consumer, when you use a service like a bank or an insurance company or say a healthcare provider, a hospital, the data, although it is yours, it is very much held hostage by that service. You go to a bank, like typically, especially, you know, the older generations, I'm going to put myself in that category. You know, I've been banking with the same bank for the past so many years, and like the whole idea of changing banks is kind of daunting to me. I have to go, you know, create trust with another bank and transfer my money, so on and so forth. Well, open banking, the whole idea is that you should not be held hostage. The data that you have with one bank should be transferable to another bank so that you get the better service, so that you get more competition between the banks, if you will, so that customers are better served. So that's kind of the driver for open banking, the whole idea that the banks can't refuse you access to your data, and that if you want to share it with another provider, it doesn't have to be a bank, by the way, it could be a credit card company, it could be a loan company, so very specific financial institutions, then you should be able to do that. And that was the main driver for open banking around the time of, say, 2015.
Okay, that makes sense. And I think, you know, certainly I'm in the same boat, and I know that, you know, oftentimes also switching banks requires schlepping yourself down to the actual bank branch in person, which I know both to do. So I can certainly get behind the benefits here. But I think probably the other side of the coin, right, are the concerns about security. And in particular with open banking, I know from what I was reading and looking through, it does tie back very closely to a topic that we've addressed before here, I think a couple of times, which is API security. And that topic still feels, if it's not like the wild, wild west anymore, it's at least obtuse at best, because there's still a lot of confusion about how to do this right, the concerns here. When you marry that with talk about financial information and banking information, I can understand why people would be potentially nervous about this. So that's such a word salad to open to a question. But David, to your mind then, what needs to happen from an access and security perspective for people to feel more comfortable, both from the user side and from the bank side, I guess, as well, about open banking?
So it's a really, really good question, Kelly. And if I go back to the definition of open banking, some of the opponents of open banking, they argue that having something as like open banking and opening up data from one company, a bank in this case, to the outside world can absolutely lead to greater security risk and exploitation of consumers. It creates an attack surface that the bad guys, the malicious actors can actually use to steal data. But that's kind of a fake argument. I think it's sort of like saying, well, I'm going to close up my borders because I'm afraid of my neighboring country. Well, that can't last forever. At some point, you're going to have to open up borders. So now that open banking is here to stay, which is, I think, really great news, how do we build APIs that are secure? And that's where the topic of API security comes in, Kelly. What are the potential attacks that we should expect? What are the potential standards that we need to put in place? And that is really what's cool with open banking as a whole, and the group known as the Berlin Group, which is a standardization group founded by, I think, 30-plus financial institutions, is that they provide implementation guidelines. They even provide open API definitions. So open API definitions are kind of like a contract that you'd want to expose. So quite literally, what the open banking specs say is, oh, if you want to share account data, you're going to have to do it this way. This is what an account is going to look like. This is the kind of operation you can expose on accounts, so on and so forth. And then they also talk about security risks, the major ones, and the mitigations that you can apply to those. So for instance, there's one type of attack that relates to, and when I was reading this morning, the number of acronyms in this spec is horrendous, I think. So they have something called X2SA, which is access to accounts. It's essentially what is also known as PSD2. They mention that for consumers to be able to get access to those APIs, they need to have strong customer authentication to mitigate the risk of credentials being stolen, to mitigate the risk of social engineering and phishing attacks. And it goes on and on, right? There's a long list of risks and mitigations that you can apply. And then a little later, we can also go back and talk about what OpenID is doing in that space in terms of API security and mitigating the risks.
I like that idea, because that kind of brings me to the next question, or I guess point for conversation, which is that, very glad that there are people, very smart people, thinking about all of this. It does sound as though you would have to, in an ideal world, you would have a bank that is very mature in their approach, not only just to API security, but also, as you mentioned, to some really core identity and access management practices like authentication. But we know as well, though, that the number of organizations, though, to be fair, banks, I guess, are more on the cutting edge there. But for the majority of organizations, their IAM maturity is still not as advanced as I think we all want it to be, or all wish that it were. So with that then, David, how do we mitigate that? How do we close that gap? How do we help banks become more mature so that they're not only able to adopt open banking, but they're able to do so in a way that reassures their users and customers that they're very secure, that the risk here is, there's nothing that's no risk, obviously, but that the risk here is an acceptable one. And I have a feeling this is where the ID Pro Foundation is going to come in, but curious your thoughts there.
Yeah, it's a really good question, Kelly. And this is where two things are going to help a lot and have been helping, right? Open banking has been around for nearly 10 years now. And there's been a lot of cool development happening. On the one hand, you have the legal bodies, right? So the legal bodies in the European Union, in the UK, and in other countries. If you go to the Wikipedia page for open banking, you'll see that the original work might have been done in the EU and PSD2 might have been the first framework. But since there have been many spin-offs of that framework in different legislations, say in Africa or South America or maybe, who knows, even in the United States. And so these are just variations of the same framework that dictates the same best practices, the same expectations as well in terms of sharing data. Let's not forget that one of the main drivers for open banking is the ability to share the data, is the ability to increase competition between the players. And because it has become law in many places, banks have to implement open banking because it becomes a compliance aspect, right? They can't just say, no, we won't do it. No, they have to comply with whatever the law says. Okay, so PSD2 is an example, of course, in the EU. But what it means is that you have standards bodies, especially in the IAM space. So the likes of IETF, of course, who own the OAuth spec, the likes of OpenID, who own FAPI, F-A-P-I, which essentially is a research group on financial-grade APIs. But you also have, you mentioned ID Pro, organization for identity professionals. And what's cool with ID Pro is that you get practitioners both from the vendor side, the companies, the likes of Axiomatic and Ping and Okta and Microsoft and so on, but also the customer side, major banks, major insurance players that all get together to share their best practices. One topic that has been pretty hot for the past year and a half is how to force the adoption of multi-factor authentication. So we've known how to do multi-factor authentication for quite some time. What we've been trying to do now, and when I say we, different companies, had forced the adoption of MFA and tell people, look, we know you don't like MFA, but we still want you to do it. And of course, the next iteration of that will be, well, now we can do passwordless authentication with things like passkeys. So how do we drive the adoption of passkeys? And so organizations like ID Pro are really fundamental in helping design what that looks like. Organizations like OpenID are fundamental in writing those into spec that can be shared with the greater public and to encourage every company into adopting the same patterns, the same secure patterns.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think, yes, you're talking about this in a future episode, I would absolutely love to dig more into passkeys and passwordless authentication, because I think there's so much to uncover there and what that means, not only for the future of access management, but also in particular for the uptake of authorization, because I think they do go hand in hand there. Like you really, it's like peas and carrots or peanut butter and jam. There's one I like better, as a kid who didn't eat my vegetables growing up. But that makes a lot of sense. And it's, again, unsurprising that this is being driven largely by the European Union, because they seem to be on the forefront of a lot of these things, not only in terms of identity-related initiatives, but also some of those financial initiatives, right? And this, I'm going to show my age here, but I do remember when we got into chip and PIN technology and North America kind of lagged behind on a lot of that kind of stuff. And gosh, even Canada was ahead of the US, I recall. So I know there's kind of varying levels of willingness to take that leap, right? So what is going to be the watershed moment that gets it done, David? Is it going to be the drive from consumers to say, hey, I need to be firmly in control of my own identity and own my own data, and that is my right? Or is it really going to be a legislative push to say, hey, banks, you need to get your houses in order to be able to enable this? Or is it something else that I'm not even pointing at?
Another good point and question. And Kelly, I would have replied to a few things you said just now. So first of all, chip and pin, I remember fondly, at the time I lived in the UK, I remember when the UK made it mandatory to use a pin, and they chose quite funnily February 14th, Valentine's Day, 2006. So almost 20 years ago to do that. But it was so cool. Like the way they did the whole campaigning, there was, you know, love your pins, so on and so forth, to make sure that everyone was going to do pin adoption. Now, the other thing you said, Kelly, is that it seems the European Union is at the forefront of this initiative. And I think in part, it's because it's a very fragmented region. If you think about the United States or Canada, there are very large swaths of land where every single state or province pretty much do the same thing, right? At least in terms of banking. But in the EU, it's not the case. Of course, before 2002, we all had different currencies. Post-2002, most of the countries adopted the euro. Some of them still didn't. But even so, if you say you went to live in Germany, right across the border from France, so a five-minute walk for those who live on the border, you had to open a bank account that would not talk very easily with your bank account in France. And so as part of PSD2, that changed. Something was introduced called SEPA, which I think is the single euro payment area, which, well, in spite of the name euro, isn't really tied to the euro currency. It works with the UK, it works with Sweden, it works with other non-euro countries. But the point is, you can instantly transfer money. And that, as a consumer, is amazing. The fact that you can move your money from, say, Stockholm to Paris in the blink of an eye. Now, that's kind of why I think a lot of the innovation has been happening in Europe, is because there has been such a need to go across borders of relatively small countries.
That makes sense. And as you were saying that, then I was thinking of my own experience here, living in a small city in Ontario, but that's surrounded by a lot of rural areas where even internet access is not great. They're championing the ability to get high speed in there. So that certainly connects.
Well, you have to travel to Quebec for the podcast, right? Because it wouldn't work in Ontario.
Indeed, I'm enjoying my poutine right now.
There we go. So to answer your question, though, you asked what the watershed moment would be. That's a good question. I think a lot of it is going to come from legislation, from legal. I think both the identity practitioners and the standards communities and even the legal frameworks, they're probably moving. It's going to sound weird, but I think they're moving a little faster than what some of the consumers are. I'm thinking of my parents, you know, senior citizens.
Right.
There's probably a whole swath of consumers out there who don't necessarily benefit from or care about PSD2 and open banking and so on and so forth. And eventually, in the long run, when more and more businesses start offering products based on the notion of open banking, yes, they will care. But until then, how it's almost like how the sausage is made is irrelevant for the consumer, right? So the watershed moment, still not answering the question, I'm sorry. I think it's going to be a mixture of digital identities becoming more prevalent, potentially things like passkeys, making digital identities easier because we'll have the digital identity on our phones potentially, and there won't be a complicated setup. Taking an example here in British Columbia, you can have a digital ID called BCID, I think it's, or BC Services Card, but it's something that you willingly have to set up on your phone. And the value right now is marginal. You can log in to do your taxes. You can log in to do your medical records. So a lot of consumers don't use it because, one, they don't know it exists. And two, the benefit is very small. Only the nerds like, you know, myself or Alex Babianu of Three Edges would use it, right? So when digital ID becomes more prevalent, it's going to open more opportunities for businesses to operate on the basis of that, and is going to make people care more about what open banking enables, right? But also, very selfishly, as someone who's lived in many different countries, I'm kind of hoping that the internationalization of the world we live in is going to help with that as well. The fact that today, you know, I've had to have a bank account in every country I've lived in, it would be kind of cool if somehow I could have a bank account that spans all those countries. And there are fintech startups in that space. You think of Wise, that was known as TransferWise before. They're kind of like the Skype of money, and you can use a Wise account in multiple countries. So that's probably going to be something that's going to make people think, oh, wow, this is cool. I want to get in on this.
That makes a lot of sense. And yes, I think you're right that probably the population isn't quite there yet. And we know that legislation always drives change because it forces change. Enforcement forces change. So that makes good sense. David, is there anything else, any great resources or anything like that that you would want people to take away from this conversation about open banking before I pivot to the next question that I have for you?
I just want to point people to the amount of work that's being done at the OpenID Foundation in the working group known as Financial Grade APIs or FAPI, F-A-P-I. They're doing a lot of cool stuff. They're defining the standards and the security profiles that implementers need to deploy open banking APIs in a very secure way, but also interoperable APIs between different providers. So go out and look at their documentation. It's all online. And then looking at IETF and OAuth in particular, there are new profiles such as rich authorization requests, known as RAR, and transaction tokens that aim to address the finer grade aspects of authorization, which is what I'm interested in personally. So how you go beyond just proving who you are, but also looking at what it is you can do and making sure that whenever you get an ID token or an access token, that token only lets you do what you're supposed to be doing and nothing else, right? To avoid attacks, essentially.
Excellent, thank you. I think that's great stuff, and certainly lots to learn there. So before we wish everybody happy holidays and talk to them again in the new year, I did want to give you a moment to call out some of the work that this authorization working group that we've been in is doing, and specifically what they've been sharing weekly, which is the I now call it the Rooster newsletter after your last version with that stern looking rooster image, but that newsletter that's coming out, and what a great resource that is for folks who want to learn more about what's going on with authorization. So I'm going to put you on the spot here, David, to talk a little bit more about that.
I know nothing.
That's never been the case.
So it's actually two separate initiatives. On the one hand, you have the working group at OpenID called AuthZen, which is about defining and agreeing on authorization design patterns, agreeing on what a PEP PDP interaction should look like, agreeing on a standard authorization API. So we're looking at prior art, be it in the open policy agent space, be it in the CEDAR space, be it in the Alpha space or the ZACWL space, and we're trying to standardize one API that all frameworks and vendors can agree on to simplify the integration of products with authorization solutions. So that's one thing, right? That's the OpenID AuthZen working group. You're all welcome to join. Individual membership for OpenID, I think, is $50, so it's not going to break the bank. And the other thing is a newsletter that we've been running on a weekly basis with a few of my peers in the industry around authorization specifically. And our goal there is to create an authorization conference. So what we realize is that the bigger conferences like Identiverse or EIC or the Gartner shows, they're great, but they address a very large swath of IAM related technologies, yes, which is cool, which we need to, you know, but the authorization people feel like, well, we kind of want to have our own invite. And much like Authenticate, the conference happened, I can't remember how old it is now, but it's at least probably 5-10 years old, came along to focus on authentication specifically, backed I think by FIDO and the Kintera initiative, if I'm not mistaken. We also want to have something similar in the authorization world. So Sarah Giacchetti from AWS and I and a few others got together at IW back in October in the Silicon Valley, and we decided to create this movement, if you will, and hopefully a conference, an actual conference in 2024. But in the meantime, we do have a newsletter that you can subscribe to on Substack. And I think, let me pull up the link. I want to say it is called authz.substack.com. AuthZ is A-U-T-H-Z. And there you'll get a fresh newsletter every week. It's not very long. It's clippings of things that happen in the authorization space. It's a mix of vendor news and open source news and conference news. It's a really fun read. We have fun writing it. So we just recommend that you sign up.
Fantastic. I've learned quite a bit from reading those newsletters. And I know, you know, as people start to look at, well, what do I want to focus on in 2024? Finding new sources of information or curated sources of information where you don't have to root out insight on authorization from different places, I think is going to be incredibly valuable. So thank you for pointing that out. And thank you for, you know, taking time out of your day once a month to chat about this. These conversations have been great. I hope for all of those who are listening, they've found value in them as well. And I encourage all of you to please, you know, let us know, find David or myself or Axiomatics on LinkedIn. Let us know what you're interested in hearing more about, because we'd love to hear from you. And with that, David, I wish you and your family a wonderful holiday. All of our listeners, thank you so much again. And we will catch you on the flip side in 2024.
Thank you, Kelly. Thank you, everyone. Happy holidays.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Dynamically Speaking. Stay tuned for our next one, and in the meantime, check the show notes and connect with us on LinkedIn and YouTube. And visit us at axiomatics.com to learn more about our authorization solution.